Okay, so this morning I'm going to try to give an overview of bioavailability and what soil sorption, desorption, what role that plays in bioavailability. So I'll start off by saying that the assessment of bioavailability in a soil contaminant system depends on both the intrinsic assimilation and metabolic capability of the organism, that is the biology, and the soil contaminant organism physical chemistry, obviously. Bioavailability depends, of course, on the organism, and it's highly dependent on the context in which the organism is placed. It makes no sense to talk about a bioavailability factor because every situation is different. If you're talking about microbes, it'd be one thing. If you're talking about ingestion and the bioavailability of soil contaminants in the gastrointestinal tract, that's another thing. If you're talking about dermal bioavailability, that's another thing. But I think it's useful to define bioavailability as simply the total mass removed from the system after a given time relative to a benchmark system containing everything and all the conditions except for the sterile part of the soil. And I know there are other definitions out there, but this one I think is useful. So the relevance of my talk today, I don't know how relevant my talk is, but the relevance of this talk then will be to non-covalent soil contaminant interactions. I'm not going to be talking about bound residues in the sense of chemical or enzymatic coupling with humic substances or anything like that. My talk relates to the bioavailability of compounds with respect to natural attenuation and or bioremediation of contaminated soil by microbes. And the principles I'm going to talk about also relate to the bioavailability of soil-borne contaminants to sensitive higher receptors, such as humans, and that would include gastrointestinal, pulmonary, and dermal bioavailability. And, of course, all of these things are important from the standpoint of risk and cleanup standards. I can't talk about everything in 25 minutes, and so I'm just going to plug my review article, which is not that easy to get. So if anybody wants it, just see me afterwards, and I'll make sure that you have access to it. It's in a book by Springer. So anyway, we have this system, and you've probably seen diagrams like this before. On the right, we have the cell, the critical cell membrane, in contact with water and a gas phase. And on the left here, we have a soil particle. The particle may have a rapid sorbed fraction. It may have a slower, more slowly reversible sorbed fraction. It may have a trapped fraction of contaminant in it. We'll talk about these things one at a time. And the rapid fraction would be in equilibrium with the aqueous phase. The gas phase here would equilibrate with both the aqueous and, would equilibrate with all of these systems. If you assume that gas phase equilibration is rapid, we don't need to deal with that anymore, and I'm not going to talk about it anymore. So we have this system, and the twin premises, which I will focus on in this talk, are that only dissolved molecules are capable of interacting with the biomembrane. I will mention facilitated bioavailability later. And that sorption-desorption regulates the dissolved concentration surrounding the critical biomembrane. So absorption in the human GI tract can be described similarly. It's a bit more complicated, but absorption occurs mainly in the small intestine and has about a 4 to 7 hour residence time. The intestine is lined with enterocytes, and high surface area. The cell membranes of these enterocytes is what I have represented here as the critical biomembrane. And these are phospholipid membranes, and they're coated with a mucus. The mucus keeps out particles. And so one has a soil particle, there's surfactant in the gut fluid, there's food particles, and all of these things interact with the contaminant. And absorption through the phospholipid membrane is a passive diffusion of dissolved molecules, and particle-associated molecules seem to have nothing to do with that transport across that membrane. So now let's take a look at a typical biodegradation or biouptake profile that one very often sees, a sort of hockey stick effect, it's been called, where there's a rapid loss from the soil, uptake, followed by a slowing down and then leveling off very oftentimes. And so how do we explain this behavior? One can imagine that in this region we have rate-limiting uptake or metabolism by the organism, whereas in these regions it's rate-limiting desorption from the soil particle. And then there's some transition phase in here. So I'm going to talk about both of these zones. First, I'm going to talk about the rate-limiting desorption zone. So this then is our diagram here with bioavailability with desorption rate-limiting. And here I'm going to imagine that the rate-limiting step is transfer from slower fractions into a rapidly equilibrating fraction, which then equilibrates with water and the membrane. And there have been many reports of rate-limiting desorption. This is nothing new. And it's also well known that desorption is governed by intraparticle molecular diffusion within the soil aggregate or soil particles. And so what is molecular diffusion? It's the tendency to randomly migrate in response to a gradient in chemical potential, not concentration. That's important, chemical potential, so as to achieve maximum entropy. And there's basically three types of diffusion that can go on: pore diffusion in the pore fluid, surface diffusion along the wall of the pore, and then in the organic carbon matrix, you can have matrix diffusion in this viscous organic matter phase. Now, diffusion is neat, but it's highly complicated and very difficult to apply to soil because it's dependent on so many physical chemical properties of the soil, including the micromorphology, the pore network tortuosity, the viscosity of the organic matter, all the boundary conditions that the molecules pass and going from one microparticle to another microparticle. And it can also be dependent on concentration of the sorbing molecule. So it's very complex. And when it has been used to model sorption, desorption in terms of bioavailability, there are many, many assumptions that have to be made to simplify it. I have a list here coupled sorption degradation models for bacteria. Mercifully, I'm not going to go into the mathematics of these. The degradation models are usually Monod-based or Michaelis-Menten hyperbolic functions. And the sorption desorption models have included intraparticle diffusion. There's a very good couple of papers here by Hawes and co-workers. If you're interested in that, I encourage you to look it up. But then there are some other types too. There's the linear driving force Minot model, which assumes that the rate is proportional to the difference between the concentration at the very cell membrane water interface and that in a remote part of the soil particle. And then there's the two-site or sometimes three-site first-order models, which assume first-order transfer between, say, a slow site and a fast site and the aqueous phase and the cell, all using first-order kinetics. The problem with all of these models, of course, is that they are they're highly case-specific. And not easily translatable from one soil to another. So while they are pretty neat, they're not terribly useful, and I think a lot more work has to go into this. Now, another thing they don't do is account for long times. As I mentioned, the bio depletion curve often very tails off. And levels off, or nearly levels off. They don't cover that because they assume single valued diffusion coefficients, single valued rate constants, etc. So we call that high desorption resistance, and this has been observed in many studies. It's found in both in historically contaminated samples and can be induced in spike samples. It's found for small molecules and large molecules alike, so it's not dependent on having a really highly hydrophobic compound. There's no rigorous definition of the resistant and the labile fractions, so it's hard to say. But there's often several percent or more that is in this state, depending on the perspective of the experimenter. And at present, it's not possible to predict how much will be there from molecular and soil properties. There have been attempts to estimate this fraction with surrogate stripping methods, such as gas sparging, polymer traps, or soluble inclusion agents like cyclodextrins. I'm just going to show one example. This I felt sort of obligated to plug my paper from 1987. Holy cow. Anyway, this was a study of some historically contaminated agricultural soils with the soil fumigant, dibromoethane. And this was sampled about a year after the last field application. This was about 3 years. And the top curves represent the degradation of the native contaminant, whereas the lower curves represent the biodegradation. This is under aerobic conditions of the carbon-14 labeled spike. And you can see the carbon-14 labeled spike is degraded very rapidly, whereas the native isn't. And clearly the persistence of this compound is due to some physical protection by the matrix. Now, molecular diffusion can explain the aging effect that many times people observe when they spike a soil and then under sterile conditions and then allow this pre-equilibration before adding their bacterium. And from a diffusion point of view, this can be explained readily. If you have absorption pre-contact time at a constant concentration, you start loading up the particle, and eventually you reach equilibrium where the concentration inside the particle is constant. Now, if you interrupt this with a bio-uptake or biodegradation event for a preset time, if you've only equilibrated for a short time, you remove what has gone partway into the particle, but diffusion, because it's random migration, allows some of the chemical to diffuse further into the matrix as time goes on. So some of that goes in while you're degrading most of it, and you're left with a little bit in here. So If you wait a little longer, you're left with more in there. So there can be the appearance of forming a highly resistant fraction when actually it's just diffusion going on. There's also the rebound effect here, where now if you stop the biodegradation event and let the sample sit, you can get migration of molecules from the interior of the particle back out to the surface, and you get a reappearance of chemical in solution. So I mentioned that individuals have attempted to correlate desorption and biodegradation resistance, and here's some examples. Land farming of PAH contaminants using a two-site model and the 10X trap method. 10X is a polymer that traps what's in the aqueous phase. Another example over here where they biodegraded native PAHs in a sediment, and then this example, which we conducted using 15 different soils and phenanthrene pre-equilibrated for, I think it was a year, and then we added this Pseudomonas degrader. And you know, the correlation isn't perfect, but there is a fairly good correlation between the fraction biodegraded and the fraction 10x trapped at a given this 100-day period. So now I also mentioned that you can have a fraction that is essentially trapped in the solid, and there's some speculation about that. So what could be causing that? Well, we could have diffusion from very, very remote sites that are otherwise not extraordinary. They're just the same sites. They're just buried deeper into the soil aggregate. And, you know, many people believe that this is the explanation for that. There's also the possibility, however, of real entrapment. PAHs, for example, in soot particles, PAHs are intermediates in the gas phase production of soot. And there are several papers that have suggested that as the soot condenses out of the gas phase, it traps some PAH molecules in the interstices of the soot particles. There's also the possibility of matrix trapping due to swelling shrinking by the adsorbate. In this case, you have sorption to a carbonaceous solid. That causes the solid to swell, and we know that this happens. And then when you desorb, the solid shrinks, and as it's shrinking, it becomes stiffer as the sorbate leaves the solid. The solid resumes its stiffness and collapses around some of the molecules, trapping them in essentially closed pores. I'm showing you here some evidence that we published a couple of years ago for this. It's highly circumstantial, but I think there's some credence to it. What we did was we sorbed, and then we carried out some isotope exchange experiments with carbon-14 labeled 1,4-dichlorobenzene at both the final sorption point in both directions. And then we did a partial desorption and then carried out another isotope exchange. And at this point, I have represented here the fraction we calculate that could be in a trapped state, and it was very close to zero. So we get complete exchange, isotope exchange here, and it doesn't look like there's any trapped fraction. However, if we go from here and desorb completely, we find that there is a fraction that strongly resists exhaustive extraction with 10X, three times, 21 days each time. And we did this at two different concentrations, and you can see this trap fraction is as much as 20% of the initial amount. That's something that we ought to have been able to see in the isotope exchange experiments. It's greater at the lower than at the higher concentration that we did this series of experiments. And so we think that this desorption resistance of this has to do with the act of bulk desorption from the solid. which caused the matrix to collapse around some molecules. Again, not proof, but now, again, this 1987 paper on EDB from historically contaminated samples, we carried out some temperature dependence of desorption, and we measured an desorption activation energy of 66 kilojoules per mole, which is really quite high for such a small molecule. And other analogous experiments have been done on larger molecules, and sometimes these desorption activation energies are, you know, at least this high. And one can suggest that maybe this is consistent with desorption being requiring a cooperative matrix flexing process in which the trapped molecule now can only get out if the matrix flexes to let it out. So then there's the topic of facilitated bioavailability, and that's the ability to directly access sore molecules or to somehow promote desorption. And there's a number of examples where apparently the biodegradation rate exceeds the maximum desorption rate observed by stripping techniques such as sparging or 10x trapping. And there's a number of possible causes for this that have been proposed. It's been proposed that the microbes release biosurfactants that favor solubility enhancement of the chemical. Direct mining of the chemical by this extracellular polymeric substance that it uses to attach to surfaces. Now, these are neat, but there's two problems with them. One is that most sore molecules are essentially out of reach of cells. Most surface area of particles is in the micropore and mesopore range, which are too small for cells, much less biofilms, to penetrate. And one can imagine that cells cannot penetrate organic matter, where most of the molecules are sore. The other problem is that, assuming microscopic equilibrium, the chemical potential of molecules on the very surface, or in my cells, or in the extracellular polymeric substance, or in solution, all have the same chemical potential. So why should there be any enhancement, even with the surfactants and the EPS? It's also been proposed that interfacial chemistry has been altered that weakens sorption. I don't know what to say about that. I guess it's possible. And then there's finally this surface depletion mechanism, which says that the cells just create a surface depletion here by depleting the... Well, I'll get into that in a moment. Let me just show you this result here. This was a study we published a few years ago. We looked at PAHs in coal tar contaminated soil. And again, we find a fairly good correlation between the desorption resistance measured by 10x method and biodegradation resistance for all these PAHs. However, if we just simply add nutrient broth to this, we somehow get facilitated bioavailability here. We get much greater rates of biodegradation than we do desorption. And this is quite puzzling, because how does suddenly, you know, just by adding nutrients, turn on these facilitated processes? And so our hypothesis is this surface depletion hypothesis, which says that passive enhancement of molecular diffusion occurs by steepening the concentration gradient at the interface. So we imagine there's a layer of stagnant water here, and with an active biofilm, you deplete the chemical in here. That drives out by diffusion, because it steepens the concentration gradient into this stagnant water. Stripping agents, on the other hand, like 10X and gas bubbles, they can't penetrate this stagnant layer, so they don't deplete the chemical in the stagnant layer. So I think this is a satisfying but still unproven method. I probably ought to stop at this point. I had some other interesting things to say, but it looks like we run out of time. So, sorption, desorption, both rates and equilibria are central issues in bioavailability. I unfortunately didn't get a chance to talk about the equilibria. I will say, however, that sorption will, or rather, bioavailability will decrease as the chemical concentration decreases, and that's because the sorption isotherm is nonlinear. The molecules are held more tightly at lower concentration generally than they are at higher. So you will see a bioavailability decrease with the extent of degradation, no matter what, as long as you have nonlinear sorption. Sorption, desorption is controlled by intraparticle diffusion. Progress has been made in modeling, but still highly case-specific. High desorption is resistance is commonly observed and can be correlated with biodegradation resistance. Entrapment can occur by physical methods, such as an occlusion method or a matrix swelling shrinking method, but so far these remain unproven. Facilitated bioavailability is not completely understood, but I favor the surface depletion mechanism. And I didn't get a chance to talk about the last, so I'll leave it off. Thank you.
The paper is now open for comments or questions. We've got only short time, but quick questions.
A very good talk. Just a question on the last example you gave. You said interface depletion. For people who use this 10x prep, I think normally they mix the mixture pretty well. So you mentioned a second layer. That still could be there?
Yeah, we're talking about submicrometer dimensions here. We're talking about a stagnant film on the surface that I think that the gradient of chemical probably extends further into solution without something right there. This kind of concept is actually known in physical surface science in other contexts, so it's not really new. In fact, actually in microbiology too, because it's been shown with crystals of chemicals that if you create a biofilm on a crystal, you actually enhance degradation that way.
I think we've run out of time. So please join me in thanking Dr. Pignadello for such a